Welcome to Let's Talk ETFs. I'm your host, Jason Kapoor, and I've been monitoring the investment space throughout my entire career. Here at Seeking Alpha, I'm an ETF strategist, and my role is to uncover and bring forward news and information to the investor community that is meaningful and actionable. Each week, a different guest and I will take an in-depth look at a particular aspect of the rapidly evolving exchange-traded fund space, with a focus on how investors can best utilize ETFs to reach their investment goals. Before we begin, a brief disclaimer. This podcast is for entertainment and educational purposes only. Nothing said here should be taken as investment advice. All opinions expressed on this show are those of individuals expressing them alone. A full set of disclosures will be included at the end of this show. You can subscribe to Let's Talk ETFs on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or whichever podcast platforms you prefer. For reference purposes, this podcast is being recorded on the afternoon of August 24th, 2021. Joining Seeking Alpha today, we have a special guest, Jay Hatfield, CEO at Infrastructure Capital Management. Jay comes to us today with almost three decades of experience in the securities and investment industry. Earlier in his career, he was the head of investment banking unit at CIBC Oppenheimer and a principal in an investment banking unit at Morgan Stanley. He began his career as a CPA at Ernst & Young. He also holds an MBA from the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania and a bachelor's degree from the University of California, Davis. Currently at ICA, he is the portfolio manager for the InfraCap MLP ETF, ticker AMZA, InfraCap REIT Preferred ETF, ticker PFFR, Virtuous InfraCap US Preferred Stock ETF, ticker PFFA, and a series of hedge funds as well. We're excited to have him here to discuss our topic of the discussion around inflation and how it's affecting the exchange traded fund marketplace. So without further introduction, let me introduce Jay Hatfield.
Great. Thanks, Jason, for having me on your podcast.
Absolutely. How's everything going there today?
It's going extremely well.
And for listeners tuning in, Jay, you're over in Midtown, correct? In New York City?
Yes, our office is in Midtown, Manhattan.
So I think the best way to kick this episode off and the way we usually like to start everything up for our listeners is if you could provide us with a little bit more insight to what Infrastructure Capital Management is all about, who Jay Hatfield is, and why is our audience listening today? You know, a little bit of a better picture of, you know, the background.
What we focus on is providing ETFs that have attractive levels of income, typically generated from asset-intensive businesses that have stable long-term assets that provide the ability to deliver stable income. So that includes assets like utilities. I used to be a utility investment banker, so we looked at asset class. Pipelines, which are also many times FERC-regulated, so they're like utilities, that portion of their businesses. Real estate. Certain industrial companies. So companies that have good business models that are going to be around over the long haul and can provide stable income to investors. Because we do think that many investors can overlook that component of investing, particularly in this type of market where the Fed is putting in so much liquidity that it's easy to just kind of spray money into the market and do well, but not think kind of long term. Well, what happens if the Fed tightens or the market goes down? What am I left with? And when you have income securities, even if they go down, you're left with the same amount of income at a higher yield. So we like to counsel investors to, you know, add at least some component to their portfolios of income securities with substantial yields.
Excellent. I appreciate that for the background drop. And I guess we could really kind of jump right into it. So, you know, inflation and interest rates is going to be the name of the game today. And I know everyone has some opinion on inflation and how it might affect from a longer term perspective, while other individuals are on the transitory boat. I ultimately just wanted to get your idea and your big picture take on what inflation is looking like today
kind of projected forward? You know, what does ICM view it as?
Okay. Well, I think just going a little bit broader, if you're going to make a macro assessment, the most critical thing is to analyze the Fed, or we call it follow the Fed, but analyze what the Federal Reserve is doing. And then the other thing you need to look at, because this is the sector that they impact the most, which is housing. So for instance, just to prove that point, if you look at the 10 recession, post-World War II recessions, every single recession had a Fed tightening. Many times they inverted the yield curve, so short rates went above long rates, but they always were dramatically raising short-term rates. And in 9 out of 10 of those recessions, the housing market crashed. So if you had just followed those two rules, you would have been well aware of the impending recessions that the Fed was inducing by following their fact that they're raising rates and then looking at how that's impacting the housing market. Now, we're talking about recessions. In this case, we're talking about a boom. And so what has the Fed done over the last year? They've decreased rates to zero and had extraordinarily loose monetary policy. Now, this sounds technical, but nevertheless needs to be analyzed if you're really going to be a great investor. The way to assess what the Fed is doing is you look at how much money they've created. And there's a somewhat fancy term for that called monetary base, but it just really means money plus money that the Federal Reserve has on deposit with the banks. The banks have on deposit with the Federal Reserve. So it's the equivalent of cash. So over the last year, they've increased the monetary base or money by 50%. And just over the last 12 months, which is pretty close to the same, it's 25% because they ramped it up very substantially in the first month and then it kind of attenuated. So it's a little bit like you're playing Monopoly, if you've ever done this, and put $500 on free parking. And then all of a sudden, everybody buys everything at any price. So we're really going through that. But that's called the quantity theory of money. And the Federal Reserve kind of doesn't believe in that right now. But they kind of got away with it in the financial crisis because that was such a horrendous downturn and very long lasting. But here we have the opposite, where it's transitory. So we have extraordinarily loose monetary policy. The Fed has said it's transitory. But keep in mind that the Fed has missed every economic projection that they've made since the pandemic started. For instance, they forecast that the unemployment rate would be 10% at the end of 2020. It's actually ended up being 6. They said GDP would be down 7, ended up being down 3.5. So first of all, the Fed has been very inaccurate in forecasting. But the sectors to look at to see if it's transitory is housing. So housing prices are up 18% year over year, and rents are up 10. And by the way, rents don't get reflected in CPI. They get reflected in CPI with a huge lag because of the way the BLS calculates CPI. So if we marked CPI to market, the inflation CPI would be about 8%. In other words, reflected rents at the 10%, not the 2. CPI would be at 8, and PPI is also around 8. So in my mind, the argument isn't really between whether inflation is transitory or accelerating. Is it accelerating a kind of mid single digits like 5, or is it going double digits like over 10? The other data point to look at is steel. So the other area that's not as critical, but the Fed impacts are autos and consumer durables. Well, guess what that creates extra demand for? Steel. Steel, now this is a little bit more confusing because there is a supply chain issue, which is what the Fed is kind of pointing to. But housing, of course, disproves that because you can't have a big dislocation in the stock of housing. There's 139 million houses already built. So clearly the housing inflation they've induced is not a supply chain issue. But with regard to steel, okay, you could say, well, that's transitory, but there is a hyperinflation going on in steel, which the Fed never talks about. It's up 200% year over year. And obviously steel is reflected in everything. So this is why, like I said, the debate is not transitory because, you know, of course, keep in mind the Fed's real target is somewhere between 2 and 3. But the, like I said, the issue is like maybe it goes down to 5, but it could easily accelerate double digits because the monetary base is increasing at 25% a year, which would imply 25% inflation. We have a hyperinflation going on in steel, admittedly supply chain, but supply chain should not create a 200% increase. And then that's rippling through this into other sectors like shipping, because it takes steel. Ships are made out of steel and containers are made out of steel, and those rates have gone up 50%. So there's a real argument for a double-digit inflation if you mark rent to market. So we kind of see it running 5 to 10 and don't see any chance of 3. And many Fed governors like actually believe that as well. Kaplan, Bullard, who are the more economists, and the politicians, you know, led by Powell, Powell needs to get renominated. He's the one sticking to the party line that it's transitory because he wants to get some legislation moved, or I don't know how he does, but the administration wants to get some legislation moved. But that's, I think, the best framework to look at inflation is we're kind of running 5 to 10. The Fed has not been accurate in their projections. So transitory is probably more of a political comment than that has really no substance to it. And so we need to kind of figure out in a 5 to 10% inflation environment, what's the Fed going to do and what's the best way to invest?
Absolutely. And kind of building off your ending point, using that 5 to 10 framework, you know, what sort of, I guess you could say, exchange traded funds or market instruments out there might an investor look at that can see, you know, that could thrive in that situation? And then also some instruments that might crumble in that situation.
Right. Well, so the other, just other one kind of backdrop that we need to have is to kind of look forward to 22, because the market's pretty distorted right now. Like I said, you can kind of just throw a dart into, you know, the Wall Street Journal and pick any asset class and it'll go up. But if we look into 22, the most likely case is the Fed has to raise rates at least 2 times. Taxes, particularly corporate taxes, have gone up as much as $250 billion. And we have a big fiscal headwind because of the fact that we don't have the stimulus payments that went out in the second quarter of this year. So we're going to have stagflation. The Fed is going to have tapered, probably raising rates. Inflation is probably going to be 3 to 5. Because again, my 5 to 10 is assuming that the Fed does nothing. But if they raise rates, of course, they'll be able to bring it down. So they're raising rates and growth is slowing. So, and if you accept that scenario, which we've seen flavors, you know, the beginnings of this year and this rotation going on, but you'd want to rotate more into the stocks that we normally like, which would be what we call defensive dividend stocks. So that would include, you know, the preferred stock funds or preferred stocks. We run funds in that area. But it also includes things where we don't have ETFs, but we do think are long-term attractive in most markets, frankly. But things like utilities, consumer staples, drug companies with good yields, REITs with good yields. So the defensive sectors we think will do well. And this isn't really that radical a point, because those sectors have done much better since mid-May when inflation printed hot and people started to anticipate a Fed tightening in 22. So we've already seen the beginnings of that trade. The only thing that's a little bit confusing is people also buy large cap tech as a defensive trade. And so then the S&P start rockets higher because it's 40% of the S&P. But you've seen that big rotation start already. But we think those, what we call defensive dividend stocks, will continue to do well. In an inflationary environment, the commodities should do well. It just kind of, there's a little bit of a push-pull between the decelerating growth and accelerating inflation. The commodities should do fine, but are, you know, clearly a little bit more volatile. So if the stock market trades off, they would trade with them. So the defensive dividend stocks are more kind of all-weather securities. And again, let's say that maybe you buy some utilities or you buy some preferred stocks, maybe rates trade, you know, go up higher because of inflation, but it's not the end of the world. Maybe it trades off 2 or 3%, but you're still getting a 4, 5, 6, 7% yield that makes up for a lot of lost, you know, short-term blips in your net asset value. So that's why those investments can be kind of added to in most environments. We do think in 22, they will tend to outperform other sectors.
And what about, I know you hear all the time, I know people hear all the time, the idea of rotation of value. I know that's to some degree in the defensive world, but what about financials, even energy? I know that's tied a little bit to commodities in the energy market, but right. How about areas like that?
Well, in that scenario I laid out, the financials would do well because the yield curve, the short-term yields would be high, you know, higher, obviously. So the Fed raises rates twice, then that's beneficial to banks, because a lot of people don't focus on the fact the banks can't take an infinite amount of interest rate risk. So everybody kind of says, oh, well, look, long rates are going down, their net interest margins are going to be terrible. But actually, they have relatively short duration assets. So what really matters to them is the spread between deposits and what they can lend the money out. So short rising Fed short-term rates is good for banks. So banks should do relatively well. And then commodities are more driven by whether the rest of the world is recovering. So is Europe fully vaccinated? Are they fully open? Is international travel? So it's a little bit disconnected from Fed policy and inflation and a lot more connected to global economic growth.
Excellent. Yeah, I was going to say, if we segue over towards the commodity space, I know you mentioned steel earlier, but kind of in that aspect of any rising inflationary period or, you know, potentially down the road rising rates, what sort of ripple effects can the commodities market see? I know you said it's a little bit of that push-pull relationship where there is some degree of connection, but at the same time, there's not because it's a global factor. I was wondering if you can go a little bit deeper into that aspect. And obviously, that will touch many different ETFs across the market.
Well, I think that just to start with, on the commodity side with oil, we've been saying that the relevant range for the rest of the year on oil is 65 to 75. Now, that view was challenged over the last week because of the slowdown in China. But what I can tell you, having watched it through a lot of cycles, people tend to overestimate the volatility of Chinese oil demand. They're growing their economy at 6% a year, mostly because they save 40% of their GDP and invest it. And if you're growing at 6, you essentially have to use about 3% more energy per year. So the demand picture is pretty strong in China, but that did, so there's a bit of an overreaction to the fears about China last week. So we're sticking to the 65 to 75 range this year. And then next year, we think it could be more 75 to 85, but it is dependent on the rest of the world being vaccinated, which is underway, but happening somewhat slowly. Europe is caught up to us. International travel returning and, you know, economic growth picking up, probably picking up more in the rest of the world than the United States, because we've kind of pulled some growth forward by overstimulating the economy in the second quarter with both loose monetary policy and fiscal stimulus. So the U.S., the good thing about oil would be the U.S. could be slightly decelerating, but global demand could be high. So it could be that it's fairly defensive in that environment, but it's more risky than buying utilities and consumer packaged goods, because it is dependent on global demand and a recovery in the global economy. So you just have to keep that in mind. And then other commodities, you know, are probably the same thing, are going to go along with industrial production and global demand improving, you know, most likely in 22.
Absolutely. I appreciate that. And I know that you mentioned when we were talking about CPI and housing and rent, you know, I was curious to know for market participants that are tuning in, what are some of the key leading, I guess you could say, data indicators that someone could be looking at that might sway the overall outlook on rates and inflation with the Fed? I know Powell has harped on employment, I was curious if there was any other data points that you're looking for or looking at that might drive sentiment in either direction.
Yeah, well, that's a great question. I would just make one point, which is it's important to distinguish between long rates and short rates. So strangely, now I think that long-term treasury rates, 10 years and longer, are probably ahead of themselves. But you can have a situation, which is what we saw in May, where people started to say, oh, the Fed's going to raise rates in 22. And the long end actually rallied and the yield curve flattened. So you have to make distinction between long and short rates. But I do think with the, even if the Fed hits its target, which is kind of implicitly now 3, it's unlikely that treasuries stay at 1.25. And treasuries are a global commodity or global asset class. So if the rest of the world's recovering, then treasuries are going to be probably higher. So in that type of interest rate environment, the indicators you'd want to look at, I mentioned already, so you can see if the Fed, let's say the Fed tapers and they're claiming that they're going to reduce inflation. Well, the Case-Shiller index comes out every month. Again, housing prices running 17% year over year. Maybe they come down. I don't expect they will until the Fed actually raises rates. But because they're really, it's not like they're, when they taper, they're not really restricting monetary policy. They're just throwing less gasoline on an already burning fire. I mean, they're not going to shrink the balance sheet. They're just going to grow it at a lower rate. So I don't believe that that'll have any impact whatsoever on that housing market. And it's going to continue to have higher prices. And rents, you can track. Don't look, of course, at the BLS numbers because they're doing surveys of owners, which owners don't even really know what their houses rent for. But you can, there's this thing called the internet. We should show the BLS how to use it. And you can look up and just say Google, you know, year over year rates, and Zillow and other websites give you pretty good estimates, and they're running about 10%. So, you know, maybe, you know, Powell's right. And even though they're still throwing gasoline on the housing market, rents start to go down. I don't see any reason why they would, but that's something to track. Certainly steel, I don't think steel is necessarily going to hold the levels it's at now, up again in a hyperinflation. But, you know, if it's up 200% and has to go down 66 to just get back to where we were before the pandemic starts. So I continue to watch steel. Other commodities have attenuated. You know, I'd say the rents are the most critical because that's going to require people to demand higher wages because you can't avoid rent. You cannot drive, go on long vacations if gasoline prices are high. So I'd look at the, you know, demand for wages because of rents and then the job market. But keep in mind that there's 12 million people that are unemployed right now. 9 million of them are on pandemic unemployment assistance. So that's a supplemental program. So they never had to document that they had a job and got laid off. And so that's 3/4 of the unemployed people. So there's a likelihood that in September 9th, when those programs mostly end, that you're going to get, you know, an uptick in the jobs created because there will be more people willing to fill jobs. So, of course, the Fed's focused on employment, but we're pretty bullish that employment will improve pretty substantially after that point. But again, that's not determined yet. So certainly I wouldn't necessarily look for the September job report because it might miss that because of the surveys in the second week. So look at weekly tracking of jobless claims, continuing claims. And then in October is when you should see the real acceleration in employment if we're correct at the ending of those, not just the $300 supplement, but those other 9 million people on pandemic unemployment. So those are really the key indicators, employment, and then the housing market, and particularly rents.
Excellent. And so now kind of having a better picture of what we're looking at, how would you kind of recommend, or what would you say for an investor that might be tuning in to kind of adjust their portfolio in a sense to set themselves up down the road? What can they do today to, you know, put themselves in a better position tomorrow? And is it the right time to make the decision today? Is it, do we need to wait a little bit until hear what the Fed has to give us? And kind of along those lines, I know that we discussed the idea of some, you know, dividend base, more defensive, but ultimately, is it something we should be running out to the markets today to do? Is it?
Well, you know, actually, strangely, like I said, it's been rewarded, even though it's really more of a 22 phenomenon. It's been working reasonably well, even since mid-May. So things, these defensive securities have participated in the rally. But in theory, I guess, if you, I mean, we always counsel, you know, long-term asset allocations, dollar cost averaging, and if you're going to make a change, do it very gradually. So this is not like a sounding the alarms, go do this trade tomorrow. And if you had any doubts about that, you know, we had a horrendous news flow last week. Afghanistan, China slowdown, Delta worsening. Market goes down, you know, 1 or 2%. It gets a little bit close to 50-day moving average, and now we're hitting higher highs. So there's clearly no emergency to, you know, make any big rotations in your portfolio if you're fully, I would be fully invested. But not just for 22, but in the long run, I think all investors should have a target dividend yield. And maybe if you're younger, your target dividend yield's 1.5 or 2. But it shouldn't be zero. You shouldn't be all in Bitcoin and you know, Tesla and, you know, ARK type investments that are going to work out in 5 or 6 years. Now, it's great if you're younger to have a good component of those, but you should be potentially harvesting gains if you have big wins there and saying, okay, well, I want some of these defensive dividend stocks that I can kind of hold forever. A lot of them are Dow stocks. You know, preferred stocks are mostly issued by large cap public companies. So those are very stable long-term investments. So we think you should create an allocation to that sector. If you build into it slowly over time, like I said, maybe you have a big gain in a speculative stock. You can, you know, take half of that, put it into another defensive stock, or take another aggressive stock, but you can take a quarter and put it in kind of your money machine, which are these dividend producing companies with typically with assets or great franchises. Like drug companies don't, you know, have like real assets, but they have drug licenses and franchises like that. So these kind of super blue chip stable companies, good dividends, or their preferreds, and add that income component and just gradually see the income build up over time. And then once you get to that level, you can also look forward to the end of the month because you get paid by your stocks. And so you don't have to worry as much about whether they're up or down that month.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that you kind of hit it out of the park with that aspect that it's not sounding the alarm bell that we have to go run to the markets tomorrow, but it's that kind of pendulum swing if you're looking from a longer term perspective, if, you know, to dollar cost average in and how you can kind of build that out over the course of a longer duration versus, you know, and again, obviously it's all appropriate to whatever your portfolio structure is. I wanted to actually shift gears a bit to some of the ETFs that ICM provides. I know you guys have three funds out there, the InfraCap MLP ETF, ticker AMZA. You also have a preferred REIT ETF and a US preferred stock ETF. And I was curious if you could give our audience a little bit of a brief rundown of what those funds are about, what they look like, just some information around them, how they could potentially be applied to the markets today, down the road, things of that nature.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll start with the our flagship fund, which is a $500 million fund. That's PFFA. And so that's a active preferred stock fund. And in that fund, we run like a closed-end fund that does preferreds. We run modest leverage of 20 to 30%. And instead of the broad index ETFs have 450 securities and diminished kind of very, very small positions in all those, we have 125 issuers, 175 issues. Most of the issue side positions are 2 to 3%. So in that fund, we're looking for good credits, good to great credits, but we do favor the credits. They're called crossover credits. So their parent rating of their bonds, not the preferreds, might be investment grade. So that's BBB, but the preferreds might be BB or non-investment grade. But the reason we like those securities is that the corporation has access to capital. So again, they're public companies, they can issue equity. If they're investment grade, they can easily issue bonds in most markets. Of course, they can issue more preferred, So they can stay liquid. So they're good credits, but you get paid reasonably well, sort of 5, 6, 7, 8 for those type of companies. And the reason that we like those companies, and this is a misperception with preferreds, is that people say, oh, they're long-lived assets. So if rates rise, they're going to go, they're going to be terrible. We're going to lose all of our money. But the way to think about that is that interest rate risk can be estimated by looking at the yield. So if you buy a treasury, I mean, well, treasury's too extreme, but if you buy a muni bond, the yield's 2 and treasuries are 1, then 50% of your return comes from the treasury component. If you buy a preferred stock, say the yield's 6, 1% is coming from the treasury component and 5% is coming from the spread. Well, the spread's more correlated to the stock market. So if the stock market's relatively stable and interest rates are rising, then those securities should be relatively stable or even go up in value. For instance, our fund, early in the year, rates were heading up very rapidly, and the broad index funds, which are passively managed, have a lot of financials. They were actually going down because they have a lot of these securities yielding kind of 2, 3, 4. And our fund was going up because the market was relatively stable. So we have more sensitivity to the stock market, about 30% in a normal market, and no real sensitivity to treasuries. So that's the way to think about that fund. So that, you know, of course, if you have a dislocation and a liquidation, so last year you had that. And so in that case, we're going to underperform some because we have the preferreds that are more sensitive to the stock market and less sensitive to the bond market. So you don't want to necessarily own those type of funds going into a pandemic or a financial crisis. But of course, those don't happen very often. And you have to think about the fact too, that no securities really did well that traded on the stock market. Like utilities are actually have no real sensitivity to usage. People don't understand that because they're regulated. But a lot, like I used to have a client, Penn Power and Light, very conservative utility in Pennsylvania. And it went from like 30 to 8, made no sense. Muni bonds went crashed. So yes, because preferreds trade in the stock market, they will go down if there's a complete dislocation, like everybody's in fear and liquidation. But in a normal decline, they should have be defensive and have betas or sensitivity stock market of kind of 20 to 30%. So that's that fund, less interest rate risk, more stock market risk, but should be defensive in normal market. And then just to finish this off, so it's not too long, our second biggest fund is AMZA. So that's structured a corporation, so you don't get partnership returns called K-1. So it has a simplified tax structure. We run 20 to 30% leverage on that. So it has a better yield than the index. It's yielding over 9 right now. And we actively manage it. So we select the companies we think are better positioned within the MLP sector. It is, though, as I alluded to before, it's correlated with global growth. So it tends to be an energy prices. So it's a, you shouldn't think of it as defensive, unlike preferred. So it's more aggressive. So you're really making a bet on the global economy. You do get paid while you make that bet, but it's not in the defensive dividend category. And then our the fund that and that fund's SEC yield is right around 9.5. PFFA is right around 7.5. And then PFFR is just under 6. So that's our last fund. That's an index fund. So it's not actively managed. It does have a 3% minimum yield to call. So that's, I didn't mention this, but preferred stock funds, it's important to have active management. This could be yourself, by the way, but it may not be efficient for an individual to do it. But you need to look at the call price, which is typically $25. So you don't want to buy preferreds trading at 26, 27, 28 that are callable in the near future. So we have, we of course manage that in the active fund, but with PFFR, we have a 3% minimum yield to call feature so that at the rebalance, it sells the securities that are overvalued, like trading over 26, and buys, distributes it among other REIT preferreds. And I also mentioned that with preferred stocks, you want to have good credits because they preferred stocks are stocks. So like a regular common stock, they would typically get wiped out or have very de minimis return from a bankruptcy. So you don't want distressed preferreds. But REITs are good credits. because unlike individual buildings, they have modest leverage, usually about 40% debt, 5 to 10% preferred. So on average, they're good credits. So we think that fund, it has no leverage, and it's market cap weighted, so it tends to have a little bit more of the conservative securities. So if you want like more conservative preferred fund than our actively managed fund, of course you give up yield and probably some total return, but it has no leverage, so it's a little bit more conservative version of PFFA, and it's indexed, so it has that feature to it as well.
Excellent. Yeah. And thank you for that kind of analysis on each three. It gives our listeners out there a better grasp of some of the funds that you guys provide and how potentially they could fit into their portfolios and just, again, more information around that space. Unfortunately, we are kind of getting to the tail end of the podcast. I can go on with you for another hour or so, but I don't think everyone else would want to, or maybe they would, who knows. But I just wanted to obviously kind of from the tail end, give you the last floor or give you the last word. If there's anything that we kind of went over together that maybe you want to re-highlight or perhaps something that you want to address that we didn't go over, kind of give you the opportunity to have the last word.
Yes. Well, I think that I would just emphasize the couple of these key investment philosophies that, you know, served me well and I've learned over many years, being on Wall Street for 30 years and investing for over 50 years. So follow the Fed and follow housing. So just to get, you should always, you kind of need to understand the macro a little bit to, you know, make these asset allocation decisions. But then second, to really pound the table on knowing the income from your portfolio, because that will allow you to weather downturns. So I manage a couple of family accounts. And of course, they called me in mid-March of 2020 and said, well, should we sell all of our securities because of the pandemic? Now, you know, those calls can be good counterexample or good indicators that you should do the opposite and get really long in the market. Because of course, Monday, the Fed intervened and that was kind of the beginning of the bull market. But the reason that I was able to convince these family members to hold on is I said, well, wait a minute. You have a very conservative portfolio. You have a 4%, well, beginning before the pandemic started, you had a 4% portfolio yield. Well, now you have a 6% yield. But guess what? It's the same amount of money. Like, there haven't been any significant dividend cuts and the bonds haven't defaulted and you're still getting the same amount of money. So in the long run, you don't have to do this when you're 19, but as you get older through the years, you can say, well, look, I know the stock market's down and this is happening and the Fed's doing this. But I know I have my, you know, not just the percent, but I know I have my $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 of income. And that's my goal, is to build a stable income. And so if I'm going to do a speculative stock like Tesla or Bitcoin and I have a big win, well, take some of that off the table. It's like if you go to the casino, you don't have to, you know, the next bet doesn't have to be your entire winnings on black. So pull some of it out. Build that income and then enjoy seeing that monthly income coming in and knowing that that's kind of your money machine. So we think that that's a spectacular way for people to become long-term investors, focus on valuation, don't get burned by stocks that are being kited by pump and dump type, you know, conversations. Could do a little bit of that if you make money on it, God bless you. And then, but again, do it slowly, dollar cost average, have your allocations, but maybe just take some of that money off the table, rebalance, or whatever other investments you're doing, stick to your, you know, create these buckets, stick to them, dollar cost average. And then I guess the last point is, too, if you're going to make speculative investments, and, you know, energy stocks certainly are, we always counsel not just dollar cost average, but keep your position size smaller. So, for instance, with preferreds, we're comfortable having people have 5 to 10% of their total portfolio in that. But if you're going to do MLPs, we'd rather see you do one or two. So then if it goes down 50%, first of all, you don't notice as much, but you could then have some powder to maybe add instead of just kind of crying. But also, if you're speculating on Bitcoin or any other security without, you know, fundamental income and earnings, keep your position size small. So if you take a big loss, maybe you can double down and you don't destroy your overall capital. because a lot of investing is capital preservation, not just big wins. So that's kind of the last point, is size your positions appropriately so that you can be in the game over the long haul.
Absolutely. Risk management is always key to the game. It's not all about winning. It's also about playing the defense. Right.
And we do fear, last comment, is we do fear 22 could treat some of those more speculative investments poorly as we decelerate. But we're not certain of that. And like I said, there's no indications of that right now in the market. But the good news about adding income is that you still win anyway because you're getting paid, even if those speculative investments continue to do well.
Absolutely. And just to close out, is there anywhere, I know that you guys have your website. I don't know if you're on any social media aspect. If individuals out there want to learn more about yourself, your fund, best ways to find you.
Yeah, the best thing is to follow us on Twitter at InfraCap. And then if you go onto that, you can see our funds, which are infracapfunds.com. And you can search my name under LinkedIn. We usually post. We do try to do weekly or bi-weekly posts of what we see going on in the macro environment, because we do think that you need to understand the macro to properly do your asset allocation.
Great. Well, again, thank you for joining us today. And that's Jay Hatfield, CEO of Infrastructure Capital Management, for taking the time to speak to us today. Again, I appreciate your time, but until next time, I'm your host, Jason Kapoor, signing off. For disclosure purposes, Jason Kapoor is not long any ETFs discussed. Jay Hatfield is long InfraCap MLP ETF, ticker AMZA, InfraCap REIT preferred ETF, PFFR, and the Virtuous U.S. preferred stock ETF, PFFA.